So if anybody here hasn't perhaps been here for a lunar observance night before, those eight precepts aren't binding. It's just for a day and a night. So if you didn't just take them for, you know, some sort of, what am I getting myself into? But it's just for one day. So Ajahn Kurunadamo and Debbie have been on retreat for about 10, 11 days now with Ajahn Suchito at Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. And so much deserved time for them. I think Ajahn Kurunadamo made the comment that in the 23 years since he became an Anagarika, in the 23 years he's been living in the monastery, he's never taken this much time for himself. So it's much deserved, much appreciated that he's taking that time. And then Debbie as well, who was actually involved with the monastery 8 years before the monastery started, was involved in getting it going. So I thought I would talk a little bit about the eight precepts this evening and see where that goes. And it's always good to revisit each precept and just revisit where they come from. Everything in the practice and everything in Buddhism has an origin or has a reason behind it. Actually, everything without exception has a reason behind it. Buddhism sort of acknowledges that. So the lunar observance day, observing the full moon and new moon, which is considered like the 15-day Upasata, and then there's the quarter moons, so like tonight being the half moon, is what's known as like the eighth day lunar observance. And this is something which predates the Buddha. When in India, this was known as a fasting day or a religious observance day. And so the Buddha picked that up and thought that'd be a good idea to observe those as well. Yeah. And at first, the way it was observed was the monks would just sit in meditation together all night. And lay people would join in, but then the lay people thought, that's not so interesting. They just sit there all night. And so then the Buddha said, okay, we can discuss Dhamma. Sit for one part of the night, discuss Dhamma for another part of the night. And at a certain point, the Buddha reflected that it'd be nice if the lay people would act like arhats, act like enlightened beings for a day and a night. And then he thought, well, what are certain things that arhats, liberated beings, enlightened beings, would observe or would refrain from? And he thought there's these eight precepts. One is that an arhant would not intentionally take life. Two is that an arhant would never take what is not given. Three is that an arhant would never engage in any intentional sexual activity. Four is that an arhant wouldn't engage in false or harmful speech. Five, an arhant wouldn't intentionally take intoxicants. Six, an arhant wouldn't eat at the wrong time. Seven, an arhant wouldn't engage in entertainment, beautification, or adornment. And eight, an arhant would always resort to a low sleeping place or a low, humble sitting place and not use higher, luxurious sleeping and sitting places. So the Buddha reflecting this way, thinking it'd be nice if the lay people would undertake these 8 precepts on the lunar observance days and they could observe them for one day and act like enlightened beings for one day and give them that kind of a preview. Because these things are natural for arhants, but they're not natural for us, so we might have to pressure ourselves or force ourselves in order to keep these things. But we fake it till we make it, so to speak. We keep these precepts until they become natural. And whenever we take on these precepts, we get tested. So they're not commandments, but they're training guidelines. And if we slip up or break a precept, we can let somebody know, or let a trusted companion, a practice companion, know that we did that. And just the Buddha said, just making it known and then reestablishing, reaffirming that you're still going to try to keep it afterwards. So it's not that if we slip up, then we failed and we have to quit, but we just pick ourselves up, keep going. So they're to be used as training guidelines. So just to explain them a little bit more, the first precept, to not intentionally take the life of any living creature, that, of course, on the extreme end of things would be not to kill people, not to be a murderer, and then on the more subtle end of things, not to take the life of any creature, even down to a little mosquito or a fly. And if we've done this in the past, say if we in the past didn't hold precepts and have taken the life of creatures of whatever class or whatever type, this is something we can still, once we take on that precept and we determine we're not going to do it anymore, then that can still be incredibly efficacious on the most absolute extreme end of the spectrum. You had the Buddha's great disciple Angulimala, who was a mass murderer and killed a huge number of people and cut their fingers off and made a necklace that he kept around his neck and was feared across the land and hated, and ended up meeting the Buddha just in time before he was on his way to actually kill his own mother. And Buddha intercepted him, and Angulimala then gained faith and threw down his sword and became a bhikkhu and was able to completely do a 180 and not harm even the slightest living being since the time of becoming a bhikkhu. Although he still reaped some of the results of his past actions, whereby he would go alms around and people would recognize him and they would attack him. So there's a story in the suttas where Angulimala gets attacked and really beaten up during alms around, and he crawls back to the Buddha and why did this happen? The Buddha says, well, Barrett, you're reaping the results of your actions in this life, which, if you wouldn't have become a monk and wouldn't have changed your ways, it would be far worse after death. So you should bear this because you're reaping the results of your bad actions now. So that's the most extreme end of the spectrum. And even to the point where there's an Angulimala protection, which we do for pregnant mothers who are about to give birth, because there's a story of Angulimala where he's on alms round one day and he sees a mother who's in labor and in immense pain, and the birth isn't going so well, and he actually goes back to the Buddha and tells the Buddha what's happening, and the Buddha says, go back into the village and go up to that same woman and tell her, I have never in my life killed a living being. You know, by the power of this truth, may your birth go well. Angulimala says, how can I possibly say that? I was a mass murderer before. And the Buddha said, well, you're not lying, because when you became a bhikkhu, that's reckoned as birth in the Noble One's discipline. So that's the birth you're referring to. And so you're not lying. So then, of course, he goes back to the village and tells and goes back to the woman who still hasn't been able to give birth. And he recites this phrase for her. I've never intentionally harmed a living being since my birth. By the power of this truth, may your birth go well. And then, of course, she has a painless birth after that. So it's certainly, most certainly, something we can rectify if we have done things we regret in the past. On the minor end of the spectrum, you have annoying insects, mosquitoes, flies. There might be like a wasp nest. You might be tempted to spray them or kill them. And so that also would break the precept of killing. This is a special precept because it also is included in the five precepts being not taking life, not taking what is not given. And the third of the five precepts becomes not engaging in sexual misconduct. So this is the five precepts are the Buddhist precepts for householders who are raising families. And the fourth precept is the same, not telling lies or engaging in harsh speech. Fifth precept is also the same. But if everyone in the world even just kept half of the first precept, meaning not killing humans, so if everyone in the world just didn't kill other people, then we would immediately have world peace. There'd be no more wars immediately. So that's a very special precept. So we develop these skills. If a mosquito lands on us, we have this way of lightly brushing it away, not harming it. If there's flies around, we have ways of catching them. We have these fly nets that we used to have really severe fly problems when we had our old house, which isn't here anymore. And there was one or two years where the house would literally be filled with hundreds of flies, and we had these fly nets, and Lungpa Pasano would go around with these nets catching flies, and the kids loved it. Give the kids a fly net and have them see how many they can catch. And so you can make it fun not having to kill them. And the question might arise, well, wouldn't eating meat break that precept? And in terms of the way kamma works, if I was to have somebody kill an animal so I could eat it, then yes, that would break the precept. So also like commanding or asking also counts. But in terms of like receiving food or just, say, buying something at the store, it's too far removed karmically, so it doesn't actually break the precept. However, vegetarianism is praised in terms of having compassion for animals, but you don't break your first precept by eating meat. Unless you kill the animal yourself. Also, for us bhikkhus, we aren't allowed to eat meat if we see, hear, or suspect that it was killed specifically for us. But if we don't see, hear, or suspect that it was killed specifically for us, then we're allowed to eat it. But again, if we have like a wholesome intention of refraining from eating meat because of acknowledging the way meat is produced in this day and age and wanting to refrain from it for that reason, that can be a wholesome intention to augment our practice. But here I speak of just what breaks the precept, what doesn't break the precept. Taking what is not given. Taking what is not given refers to stealing. So, that's pretty self-explanatory. I guess it gets a bit unclear with things like computers, computer software, but didn't have that in the time of the Buddha. So it includes stealing, taking things. In the monk's rules, if we steal something of considerable value, that's one of the most major monk's rules, and it's a parajika, so that we are no longer a monk if we do that. So like intentional theft of something of value. But it also has more subtle levels, so down to the extent of just not taking even a small thing, if it belongs to somebody else. If it clearly has no owner, like if it's clearly discarded, and even as monks we're allowed to take it. So like there's this practice of pangsukala cloth, where monks who undertook the practice of wearing rag robes in the time of the Buddha would say like a discarded piece of cloth on a roadside or a corpse covering cloth, we're allowed to take that because there's no owner. Very few monks would practice this day and age, but Ajahn Mun was known for always keeping this practice, using thrown away cloth, rag robes. So not engaging in any intentional sexual activity being the third precept, the brahmacharya. That's the celibacy. And so this is a renunciate precept, as opposed to the non-renunciate version, which is the not engaging in any sexual misconduct, meaning being faithful to your partner. And for the celibacy precept, this is a very important one because it really defines a renunciate or a monk, a bhikkhu. And there was also lay people in the time of the Buddha in India. There were the white-robed lay people. They would sometimes hold this precept, either just for the observance day or even for their life. And sometimes even householders would hold this precept later in life. They would then just dive into the practice and use their retirement just for the sake of practice. So then they would take on, rather than the five precepts, they would upgrade to the eight precepts. So this one has a reason that we do it, in terms of uprooting ourselves from the world of sensuality and trying to cultivate more of a mind of It's like relinquishing a lesser happiness for a higher happiness. So cultivating a mind where we aren't reliant upon the sensual world for our sense of happiness. And this is why the practice can be difficult, because there's a psychological rule, or just the way the mind works, where the mind will always default to what it knows is going to bring it some sort of happiness, either lesser or greater. And so when we relinquish a lesser happiness and strive for a higher happiness, but we haven't yet experienced that higher happiness, then there is an interim period where we're going to be constantly defaulting back to that previous happiness that we knew. We're going to be proliferating about it, hoping for it, wishing for it. And because the mind has not yet experienced that deep brightness and contentment, spaciousness, clarity, which comes from the renunciation. So that takes faith. That takes meeting teachers, meeting examples, saying, okay, well, even though I'm in the midst of these difficulties with keeping this precept, I have faith that it's possible. So we keep practicing with it, keep moving forward. And then eventually, when we do start to experience more contentment and peace and clarity, then we say, okay, that gives us a sense of confidence to keep going. Although the Buddha said that sensuality is not fully relinquished till you're almost at the final stage. So there's four stages of awakening in Buddhism, and the third stage of awakening, the non-returner, only then is sensuality fully relinquished. So until then, there's going to be some sort of struggle. The fourth precept, I prefer the old translation. In our old chanting book, it was, I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech. So now that translation has been changed to, I undertake the precept to refrain from lying, which etymologically, that's correct. But I think the intention of the Buddha with Musa Wada Varamani, that's the precept in Pali, is, because it gets fleshed out in the suttas and in the Vinaya as fourfold. So one is to refrain from lying. Two is to refrain from harsh speech. Three is to refrain from divisive speech. And four is to refrain from idle chatter. And so the harsh speech would be harsh speech out of anger, telling someone off, things like that. Divisive speech would be like being one way to somebody and then going and speaking badly about them to somebody else in order to divide people. So sowing discord, that would be like divisive speech. Idle chatter is a bit more innocent, and as Ajahn Jeff says, sometimes you need to grease the wheels, sometimes you need to be social, but idle chatter, if we're doing it too much, it can be quite harmful. And so trying to bring our speech back to what's important, what's relevant. That's the blessing of being in the monastery. We're actually allowed to not talk. We're actually allowed to not talk in the monastery, and it's not seen as something weird or unusual. Coming back to the first part of that precept, the telling of lies, so refraining from untruth or from telling lies, that one is incredibly liberating, because just when we just think about the whole web or the whole edifice that we need to build if we tell a lie, that, oh, what did I tell this person? What did I tell this person? What did I tell that person? We have to kind of all keep track of it all, and it's a real burden. And we might even think that in some professions, maybe we have to lie. Maybe it's necessary sometimes. But I like to use the example of Gandhi, who was a lawyer, and he had this precept to never lie. So he would actually ask the person who hires him, he would ask them, well, if he was going to defend them, he would ask them, well, did you do it? And if they said yes, he would say, well, I can't possibly say that you didn't do it, but I can, all I can offer is to try to get you like a reduced sentence or something. So he couldn't actually lie about it. And all of these precepts cut out a huge chunk of suffering in our lives. So like the first precept, any suffering that happens from killing living beings, we automatically don't have that as soon as we take that precept on and live by it. And anything, any suffering that comes from taking what is not given, we automatically cut that out as long as we live by that precept. Sexual misconduct or celibacy at the higher level, you know, any suffering that comes from that, we automatically cut that out. Telling lies or false speech, harsh speech, any suffering connected with that gets cut out automatically. And then there's the fifth precept, and the fifth precept isn't a moral precept, so it's karmically neutral, and that's the taking of intoxicants. So it's not morally wrong or harmful, say, to drink or to do drugs. Like in the actual doing of it, you're maybe doing some sort of physical harm to yourself, but you're not actually making the kama of harming anybody else. The reason the Buddha has this precept there is he said it's the basis for negligence. The taking of intoxicants is the basis for negligence, and it causes you to break the previous four precepts. It makes you much more likely to slip up on the precepts that are moral precepts. So the Sura Maraya Majjhapamadatana, that's in Pali, that's specifically referring to liquor, fermented spirits. And so the Buddha was referring to alcohol in that precept. And there probably was other drugs in that time, but not the huge variety we have now. So we use something called the Great Standards to extend it to hard drugs aren't allowed under that precept. So like not only alcohol, but whatever other hard drugs. People inevitably ask, well, what about coffee? And I drink coffee, so I say it's okay. But don't drink too much coffee, though. That's not good. And the sixth precept, the sixth, seventh, and eighth precept, these are purely renunciate precepts. So they're more for the sake of simplifying our life, giving us more time for inner reflection, for meditation. Sixth precept, translated as, I undertake the precept to not eat at inappropriate times. Actually, what this is referring to is eating only between dawn and noon, which is what our monks' precepts have us do. So being the lunar observance day, the lay people will live like the monks for that one day. They'll refrain from eating dinner. We don't yet have this established here, but in Thailand, especially in the Northeast, the farmers, their weekend is determined by the lunar observance days in the monastery. So they will all come every lunar observance day, and they will show up in the morning time and take the precepts, take the eight precepts before the meal, and then just have that one meal at the monastery, spend the day at the monastery doing sitting and walking meditation through the afternoon, and then doing the evening chanting and meditating with the monks through the night. So they undertake the precepts in the morning time and keep them for the day and the night, and then they're freed from them in the morning time, come dawn time. So not quite the same here. We take it in the evening, but I think for all of you who do this on a regular basis, you probably haven't had dinner this evening. But I guess technically you could have dinner and then take the precept and it wouldn't be breaking it. So seventh precept, refraining from entertainment, beautification, and adornment. These are just basic simplicity precepts, keeping things easy, keeping things clean, simple. And time for going inward. We're not involved in going out to escaping from suffering through entertainment or decking ourselves out, beautifying the body. We're not involved in those activities. Right now we're going inward and trying to look at dukkha, look at suffering directly in our mind. And so these are pointing towards meditation. The eighth precept is Ucha Sayana Mahasayana. That's the high and luxurious sitting and sleeping places. So just for a day and a night, taking a low position, taking a humble position. In Thailand, they just spread out grass mats, sleep on the floor, or a low bed, like a soft mat, a thermarest on the floor, would follow this precept. I have kind of a story about this particular precept, and this also isn't actually in the monk's 227 training rules, but we follow the eight precepts in spirit. And I was traveling in 2008 with another monk. We were traveling through Canada, and it was the person driving us was going to offer us to stay in a hotel room one night. And we went to check out the rooms, and they had the absolutely most high and luxurious beds you could imagine. And we went to look at this one room, and it had this red duvet on it, and it was like this really high bed. It was almost up to my chest, actually. It was the highest bed I've ever seen, actually. And we looked at each other and just like, this is the epitome of a high and luxurious sleeping place. We went and got another hotel. So I think that's what it was referring to. And there was we actually thought we could have gotten it if the bed didn't take up the whole room. Like, we could have slept on the floor next to the bed, but there was actually no floor space. Like, the room was just the bed. And you could, barely stand around it. So, these eight precepts, they're special. They create a foundation, a ground for us to stand on. And leads to a sense of contentment and well-being in the practice. And they are renunciate precepts. But renunciation doesn't create a sense of lack in us, but we're actually gaining quite a bit from it. We're gaining mental ease, mental contentment from it. We're shedding these different burdens. And I was relating the story at tea time, which Ajahn Amaro liked to tell, and I'll relate it again now, of the blissful mother in India. She was an ascetic who, I'm not sure how long ago she lived, and she may have passed away now, but known for, one, for her asceticism, and two, for how happy she was. She's always smiling, always laughing, always in bliss, but incredibly austere. And so being, at a certain point, she was very well known, very famous in India. So one day there was these three businessmen who went to see her and have some Q&A with her, and she would be happy to receive people and answer questions about how to practice. And so they approached her and said, "Well, we're just kind of curious because you're so austere and you have so much renunciation. and you've literally given up everything. You know, how could you do it? And when they said this to her, she thought it was the funniest thing in the world and just started laughing hysterically. And she was laughing for quite a long time. And she kept laughing. And they started getting really uncomfortable. And they were kind of like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And she sort of, at a certain point, was able to gather herself and calm down a bit. And they were sort of distraught. These three businessmen were kind of distraught at that point, and like, you know, what did we do? Like, did we mess up somehow, or what's going on? And she said, well, you think I've given up everything. It's you who have given up everything. You know, I have everything. You have given up everything. So by not having the renunciation, her view was, by not having the renunciation, that was relinquishing everything, or that was giving up everything. And everything to her was the contentment and brightness and well-being that she was experiencing all the time. So that's some of a little bit fleshing out the eight precepts and some of the reason for keeping the eight precepts. These act as a foundation for happiness, well-being, helps us to practice. Because actually, for practice, contentment and well-being is essential. It's not that we meditate and then we get the well-being. It's that we get the well-being through the precepts, then the meditation starts to come together. That's the actual order of things. When the Buddha taught about the causes and conditions for liberation, then it goes from precepts to non-remorse to tranquility to happiness and well-being. From happiness and well-being, then you get samadhi, or mental focus, mental concentration. From samadhi, you get knowledge and vision of things as they are. From knowledge and vision of things as they are, you get nibbida, which is world weariness. And from that, that's a springboard into, according to the suttas, that's a springboard into liberation. Liberation of mind, freedom. So I'll just leave that as a few ramblings, a few thoughts for this evening. So we have our Lunar Observance Night, and for those who are interested, the monastic community will be staying up meditation, and there'll be tea at midnight, and then after that, more practice and morning chanting at 3. So for anybody who's interested, that's what's happening.